Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We first have an extended interview with economist and author Robin Hennell. He takes us through a basic economic workout so that we can demystify some economic language and act better in our own interest, and not allow conservative powers to take advantage of economic illiteracy. We finish the show with Alan Sears, author of Retooling the Mind, who speaks about socialism and creating alternatives in the 21st century, so stay tuned.
We're very privileged this morning to have Dr. Robin Hennell. He is an economist, and his latest book coming up in 2010 is Green Economics Confronting the Ecological Crisis. Very pleased to have you on our show, Robin Hennell. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be on with you.
Over the last few years, we've been talking a lot about the September 11th, and it's become a memorial, but there was another September 11th that seems to be forgotten, and that is the ousting of Presidente Salvador Allende in 1973 from Chile, which led to a regime of injustice and impunity. And we never really connect the relationship between economics and impunity and violence. So in today's show, I would like to focus a little bit on, demystifying how does money, and particularly a monetary system, contribute to exacerbating the structures of injustice that, keep so many people wanting for the very essentials of life. So I wonder if you could start by talking a little bit from an economist's perspective, the difference in taxations. How are these taxes implemented, and what's the difference between a progressive and a regressive tax? So let's begin our discussion there.
Okay, Sylvia, I'm really happy you decided to sort of devote a show to some really important subjects of really just economic literacy. One of the things that's happening right now is that there is an economic crisis, and the powers that be and the conservatives are attempting to really take advantage of economic illiteracy to peddle solutions that are non-solutions and to suggest that things have to be done in ways that are totally unfair when that's not the case. There are some key areas where there's mass confusion that allows them to take advantage of this economic illiteracy. One has to do with taxes and how taxes work. Another has to do, as you know, with deficits, debt, and a third has to do, with money and banks and how does all this work. So let's just see if we can, spend some time to try and lay some of the myths to rest and just help people understand the simple parts of how this stuff really works. Because when you understand how it works, then you're better able to defend yourself from the kind of reactionary and neoliberal suggestions that people would try to have us believe are inevitable. But anyway, taxes. Yes, I understand that in British Columbia, there's a new consumer tax. There's different names for this. A consumer tax, a sales tax. In Europe, it's usually referred to as a value-added tax. All these are just different names used in different places to say that there's going to be a tax on the goods that people go out and buy. They're a very different kind of tax is a tax on people's income. So you have this sort of choice. Well, should we collect taxes through consumer taxes, sales taxes, value-added taxes, simply putting a tax on the goods as people buy them, or should we simply collect taxes on the basis of how much income did people earn during the year, and you pay a certain percentage of that income in taxes? Well, there's a huge difference in terms of how fair one system of taxes is compared to another. The language that economists use to explain all this is we say some taxes are progressive, some taxes are regressive, and then some taxes are proportional. A progressive tax is one where you spend a higher percentage of your income paying that tax, the higher your income is. That's a progressive tax. And a classic example of that would be the U.S. federal income tax, where the higher your income, the higher the rate of tax you pay on that income. That's a progressive tax. A regressive tax is the lower your income, the higher percentage of your income you will spend paying that tax. And sales taxes are classic examples of regressive taxes. Low-income people will spend a higher percentage of their income paying sales taxes than higher-income people will. There's two reasons for that. The first one is that higher-income people save more of their income in the first place. So if a poor person spends 100% of their income, then every part of their income is going to pay sales taxes because they are buying with 100% of their income. On the other hand, if a wealthy person saves 30% of their income, then 30% of their income is literally shielded from paying any taxes at all in the form of a sales tax. They're only paying taxes on 70% of their income. In any case, it's always been in the interest of lower-income people, working-class people, to support progressive taxes, and that usually means income taxes as opposed to sales taxes. There's some special circumstances that force certain governments, you know, in the direction of, in desperate times, they will try and go ahead and put through increases in sales taxes. But that's generally very regrettable. A better way to do it is to raise income taxes if taxes have to be raised.
But that also brings the question of how are taxes related to the way we compensate labor. Wouldn't we then also have to address the inequality in labor and how we compensate certain kinds of jobs more than others?
Yes. I really didn't address the fundamental question. The fundamental question is, well, what kind of taxes are fairer and what kind of taxes are less fair? And so the real question is, why are progressive taxes fair and why are regressive taxes not fair? And why are actually even proportional taxes, where everybody spends the exact same percentage of their income paying the tax, why is that not as fair as progressive taxes? There's been traditionally three arguments in favor of progressive taxes as being more fair, the more fair way to collect taxes. One is what I call noblesse oblige. It basically says, look, the wealthier, they can better afford to pay taxes than the poor. So, you know, we need somebody to step up to the plate to pay taxes for public goods, and we should expect the wealthy to engage in more charity. It's noblesse oblige. That's the underlying rationale that a lot of people give for why progressive taxes, you know, are more fair. A second argument, which I think actually, you know, strikes people as odd, but I think there's a lot of substance to it, is, you know, government services in this day and age benefit the wealthy more than they do the poor. The wealthy would like to have us believe that the government is spending on, you know, welfare mothers who are going out and buying Cadillacs. But if you take a look at who actually benefits from the majority of government spending, you could make a very credible case that the wealthy, first of all, the government spending in the first place is protecting their private property. If somebody has a lot of private property and the government's busy spending money protecting it, and I have very little because I'm poor, well, then that person is getting more from the government and more from the taxes, so they should pay for more because they are benefiting more. But I think the best argument that progressives should be, you know, should emphasize for why it is that progressive taxes are the only kind of fair taxes is that labor markets and capital markets do not distribute income fairly in the first place. Think of it this way. The income that's being received out there, some of it is fair, it deserved, and some of it was being received and it wasn't deserved income. So some of the income being received is deserved and some of the income being received is not deserved. Now ask yourself, isn't it likely that a higher percentage of the income of the very wealthy is really undeserved income as compared to the percentage of the income of the poor that is undeserved? There may be some poor people who are receiving undeserved income, but aren't they going to be fewer in number, and isn't the part of their income that's undeserved going to be much, much less than the number of wealthy people and the parts of their income that they receive that are undeserved? Now, that makes such good common sense. We should be saying it every day. And if that is true, then only a progressive system of taxation will, to some degree, correct that unfair bias that exists that the labor markets and the capital markets are causing in the first place. And the other reason that's an important point to emphasize is it focuses attention where we should always be focusing attention, and that is labor markets and capitalism distribute income unfairly. And progressive taxes are one way that we can address that, you know, in the time being, temporarily, until we can fix things in a bigger way. Regressive taxes, they do nothing but aggravate the unfairness of the income distribution in the markets. And proportional taxes, and here's the key. A lot of people say, well, really what's fair is that everybody pay the same percent. If everybody paid the same percent in taxes, that is, if we had proportional taxes, if everybody's income was taxed at 19%, and that's the way we paid for all our public goods, what that would do is it would not change the pre-tax income distribution. It would effectively be saying, we are assuming that the distribution of income out there in the first place is perfectly fair. That's where we should address the argument. That distribution of income that the labor markets and capital markets are engaging in is not distributing income in a fair way in the first place. And that's why not even proportional taxation is a fair tax system. Only progressive taxation is fair.
And that's a key point, because take, for instance, the example here. It's a university that is recognized worldwide, and yet we have more than 25,000 students. We have 100 staff who do our cleaning that don't earn a livable wage. So how do you tax those people who are doing the most onerous work in this institution, who make the least amount of money, at the same level that you tax someone who is earning the top salaries in the institution, who do the creative work? So that brings us to the myth that this creative work creates money. How is money created, I think, is the other question we need to answer, because that seems to create a lot of the justification for why that money distribution is so inequitable.
Okay. The first thing that an economist wants to do in this situation is draw a subtle distinction. In common parlance, people use the word income and money interchangeably. How much money do you make? Well, an economist would say, wait a second, I don't make any money at all. I'm not a bank, and I'm not the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. Those are the institutions that literally make money. What you really mean is, well, how much income am I going to be paid this year? And that is an important distinction, because people get themselves sort of all wrapped up and confused when they start using the word money and income interchangeably. Income is received, you know, by workers for work in the form of wages and salaries. Income is received in the form of rent by people who own land. Income is received in the form of interest when people have financial investments and they own bonds, for instance, and they are paid interest. Income is received in the form of dividends, if you own shares of stock in companies and dividends are being paid out. Income is received in all these ways by people who own what we call factors of production. The big point is that labor markets and capital markets distribute this income in a way that's patently unfair. And we need to do everything in the short run that we can do to correct that, to make the system less unfair. It's not going to make the system fair, but it will make it less unfair, and that's what progressive taxes are about. Now, money. You could have a market economy that didn't use money at all. You could have barter exchange. But that basically turns out to be very inconvenient. It simply is convenient to have something that we use in order to carry out trade. And trade, here I mean trading goods and services with one another. Now, I'm not talking about foreign trade here. Economists like to give an example. Well, in prisoner of war camps, they use cigarettes as money. Well, there was no government. No government created something called money. Instead, the prisoners simply agreed, we will trade everything we want to trade amongst ourselves in terms of how many cigarettes do you get if you sell it, how many cigarettes do you have to give up if you want to buy it. So the first thing money is it's basically a convenience that allows us to trade in sort of simpler and easier ways. Now, the government has come in from time immemorial. They created not cigarettes, but they created little pieces of coins made out of precious metals. And they established a custom whereby the trading that we engage in is basically a monetized exchange system. You sell things for money and you use money to buy things. And the money was originally coins, and the coins had some sort of precious metal content to them. Long ago, the precious content metal aspect of money that government stood behind was eliminated. In 1973, there was still sort of the pretense in the United States that the gold that the United States government had that was backing up the money supply, that if you really didn't want to hold a picture of George Washington in your hand anymore on a piece of green paper, you could go to Uncle Sam and say, give me the gold that you owe me because that's what I'm supposed to be able to get for this piece of paper. Charles de Gaulle tried that in 1973. He said, France has a lot of dollars. We don't want them anymore. Give us our gold. And Richard Nixon said, come on, Charles. We know that's not the way it works anymore. That was the end of the quote-unquote gold standard. So we now have a system in which governments have created this thing called money that they stand behind, but only in a very loose kind of way. When you go with your dollar bill to a government and ask them for some gold, you're not going to get it anymore. And everybody understands that.
I just trying to grasp this, because in a previous interview we did with Ellen Brown, she points out that this creation of money has now become almost a virtual event where, you know, by virtue of issuing a loan, a bank can then assume that that is money they created. Can you explain
that
relationship?
That is correct. And here's the thing people don't understand. That's always true. Most of the money supply in the world today is created by private banks in the process that they engage in on a daily basis of making loans. There's two kinds of money that are out there. Economists would call one reserves or high-powered money, and the other credit or credit money. And most of the functioning money supply is not that high-powered money that you could think of, loosely speaking, as dollar bills. Most of what functions as the money supply is really credit money that the banking system has created and generated. How do they do this? How are they pulling rabbits out of hats? Every time somebody deposits a dollar bill into a checking account at a bank, the bank then takes that dollar bill. They don't just set it aside. They don't put it into something that would be the equivalent of a security box. So when you put money in a checking account, it doesn't go into a security box with your name on it that you can go and get any time you want. Instead, they tell you you can go and get it back any time you want, but instead what they do with it is they lend most of it to somebody else. They lend it to somebody to buy a house in the form of a mortgage loan. Or they lend it to a business that wants to go ahead and buy new equipment. So banks will take the dollars that are deposited into, let's just say, checking accounts, and most of those dollars they will then lend out to somebody else. When they lend that money out, then essentially you still have the whole dollar. When you look at your checking account balance, then all that money is yours to spend, but in fact, they have taken most of that money, up to 90% of it roughly, and they've loaned it out to somebody else. That is what we call credit money, and that's how the banking system and the normal practice of engaging in banking activities literally creates most of what is the functioning money supply out there. Now, is this a bad thing? Well, you could say it's a bad thing because, in fact, it leads to a dodgy situation that's inherently always there. Think about it. The bank actually owes you the whole dollar you deposited. On the other hand, if you went and asked for it, and if everybody else like you asked for it, no bank would ever be able to pay all their depositors what they owe them because they don't have it anymore. They loaned it out. So banking is inherently a sort of an economic practice that we have sanctioned that always carries the potential that if people all of a sudden, sort of in large unexpected numbers, took fright and thought, maybe I better go get my money out of the bank, that you would have a bank run, and you'd have a banking crisis. And we've had many of those in capitalist history, and you could say, well, if we didn't have banks, we wouldn't have those problems. On the other hand, a lot of people would argue if you didn't have banks, then a lot of the productive lending and borrowing activity in capitalist economies couldn't take place.
Ellen also pointed out that, well, it is true that this sort of Ponzi scheme has developed where, you know, money is appearing out of nowhere by simply issuing a loan. From that dollar I have, I can lend you $100. She also pointed out that we could have a lending system where we issue loans for things we need. North Dakota State has instituted their own national bank, and they actually lend money to build a new school, and they lend money to build projects that they need, and then they pay that money with, you know, tuition, and students go to school, they pay, and that money goes back, that loan is cleared up. Why can't we do that? Why don't most governments have a national bank that can lend that money at no interest? Because where does the interest come from, and who pays for that? Obviously us.
Okay. North Dakota has a state bank. In Oregon, the legislature, the Working Party family here in Oregon, and some labor unions, Jobs with Justice, have basically lobbied and gotten some state legislators here in Oregon to sort of begin the process of creating a state-owned bank here in Oregon. There is nothing wrong with state-owned banks. As a matter of fact, it would be a terrific idea. As a matter of fact, if the Obama administration response to the incredible incompetence and havoc that Wall Street and the private banking system created, not only in the United States but worldwide, if the response had been, you guys screwed up, we're not putting up with it anymore, we can go ahead, we don't need you, we can create publicly owned banking institutions to carry out the socially useful activity of channeling the savings of some people into loans for productive economic activity. We can do that better than you have proved able to do that, and we're simply ready to go ahead and do that now. That would have been far and away the best response. It would also have allowed the U.S. government to actually launch a serious Green New Deal. Because think what the banking system has essentially done in the United States. The private banking system has for decades now channeled the savings of many people not into productive investments, you know, investments in the kinds of things we need, and they're certainly not channeling those funds into sort of the kinds of investments we need to retool our economy, you know, the post-carbon age. Instead, what the private banking system in the United States did was essentially channel the world savings, because it wasn't just U.S. savers. They were sucking up savings from all over the world, and they were channeling it into one asset bubble after another. Asset bubbles produce nothing. They are of no use. They basically are a financial game. And that's what the private banking system increasingly did in the last 30 years. So there's a wonderful case that can be made that they have proven themselves useless and that this is not such a difficult thing. The state bank in North Dakota has no trouble. Now, but the problem is not interest. And the problem isn't that banks are creating money out of nothing. That state bank in North Dakota is charging interest on the loans it makes. It's not making loans at no interest. It's making loans at reasonable interest rates. It's only making loans that whoever is borrowing has a very reasonable chance of being able to repay. And it's looking for projects that actually are socially useful investments rather than simply money-making speculative asset investments. So what's good about the State Bank of North Dakota is it's making sound loans for socially useful reasons. It's charging interest to the borrowers, and it is paying some interest to the depositors. And it's doing it in a reasonable way, and it's doing it in a way that's pretty safe. But every time they make a loan, they increase the supply of money out there in the economy, just like a private bank does. They're no different in that sense.
But how would a bank that is nationally owned and funding projects that address need in society deal with the issue of deficits? We are constantly being told that we have to tighten our belts and pay off the deficit, but it seems that this is an impossible task. How would that be?
Okay, deficits and debt. First of all, there's private debt and then there's public debt. Private debt is when Robin Hanel, Professor Hanel, owes money, and I have to worry about, am I going to be able to pay it? Robin Hanel's household runs a deficit during a year when we spend more than we actually take in income. So there's private deficits, there's private debts. There's public deficits and public debts. Whenever a government spends more than it collects in taxes, then it's running a deficit. Well, anybody who runs a deficit, whether it's private or public, basically has to borrow money to go ahead and buy more things than they are collecting income, or in the case of governments, taxes to pay for. Well, how does Robin Hood borrow money? I usually go to a bank and take out a loan. That's not the way most governments borrow. Most governments borrow money by selling things called bonds. They sell bonds, which is their way of borrowing money. Now, in the case of provincial or state governments, that's really the only way that states can run deficits. And that's by issuing bonds to finance the difference between what they're spending in a year and what they collect in taxes. In the case of national governments, it's a little more complicated. The state government has to sell the bonds to finance their state deficit because they have no other way to actually pay for what it is that they're buying in excess of what they have tax revenues for. National governments actually have another way of buying more than they collect taxes to pay for. They can just print up money. There is the single difference between a national government and state governments. Now, state governments and private individuals, therefore, are in a somewhat different situation than national governments in terms of how much debt they can afford to reasonably expect to be able to carry. At some point, if I tried to keep spending more than my income, I might have a very difficult time finding a bank that would make me the loan. At some point, a state government might have a very difficult time selling new bonds because the people buying the bonds would have to worry, wait a minute, they're getting so far in the hole. What if when I sell them a bond, they then turn around and say, we just don't have the money to pay you back? In the case of national governments, and particularly in the case of the United States, everybody knows that long before the U.S. government would actually say, we can't pay a bondholder what we owe them, they would just go ahead and print the money up. Now, that's not saying that printing the money up wouldn't have some adverse consequences, but since everybody knows that's what the national government would do rather than default on debt, then that makes it a safer bet. That means that the federal government of the United States can safely run a much higher level of debt than, say, the government of California could. Still, California can't print up money if worse comes to worse, whereas the U.S. federal government can't. Now, let me just lay one bugaboo to rest here. What conservatives will tell you, that's just what we're afraid of. We're just afraid of the fact that if the U.S. federal government keeps running deficits after deficits, then at some point when it becomes difficult to go ahead and sell bonds because the bond buyers are insisting on such a high premium, such a high interest rate to be willing to continue to lend to the federal government, then the federal government will simply go ahead and just print up money to cover the deficits. And actually, that is essentially what Bernanke has done in the U.S. government bailout of Wall Street. That TARP fund was $700 billion worth of taxpayers' dollars that was poured into the banking system. But since the Obama administration came in, there really has been no new tax dollars in the banking bailout. Instead, what has happened is the Federal Reserve Bank has essentially simply allowed the banking system to borrow at zero interest rate from the federal government in a way that is simply increasing the U.S. money supply. And the conservatives will say, well, this is a very dangerous thing because it inevitably leads to inflation. In the very, very long run, if the supply of money increases faster than the growth of the economy, you could make the case that in the very, very long run, that might lead to some inflation. But the trick is this. Just because the money supply increases doesn't necessarily drive up prices and create inflation. There's a thing called the velocity at which the money circulates. And what's happening right now is money is not circulating. The people with money, and in this case it's a lot of the big Wall Street banks, they are sitting on their money. They are just not doing anything with it. So it is not circulating. So when Bernanke keeps pouring more money into the system, it's not driving up prices. It's that the velocity of the circulation of the money that's out there is simply getting slower and slower because the banks aren't doing anything with the money that they're sitting on. So the truth of the matter is that at this point, the federal government of the United States can easily run deficits bigger than they are. It creates no danger that we are about to have inflation whatsoever. And in the situation in which we find ourselves, and that is we need more stimulus, then in fact that's the sensible thing to do. And to have this debate where people are saying, no, we have to worry about the deficit right now, is very, very counterproductive. It's leading to all those proposals for austerity measures that are going to further cripple the U.S. and the global economy.
Stay tuned for the conclusion of the interview with Robin Hanel.